the morning news on, another city's up in flames. Chicago had 20 killed overnight. They want you to believe it's about the color of
your
skin.
Oh, but Joel, I hate that the listeners missed the sing-along that just happened. I don't know if you could describe it as epic. I don't know if it reached those kind of proportions, but it was pretty close.
If you put the word fail behind it, it would certainly qualify.
Yeah, there you go. Yes, it did.
No, it was a lot of qualified. Fun. I think we're both of the mind that Jason Slaughter should have hired us as backup singers, and it's his loss, quite frankly.
It is. Yeah. I think he needs to do like a 2024 mix of the song and include the appropriate backing vocals that you expressed.
I think that would be smart, personally. Yeah.
But the funny thing is, man, I mean, we just play that first part of the song, so that's all I know. And I know it well, but once we move into the next part, I don't know.
Well, we'd have to rehearse a little bit.
Yeah.
Because there's more than half a verse to the song.
I got to listen to the rest of it sometime.
Yeah, sometime you should just play the whole song. Like when you're driving down the road or something.
I got you. Yeah. Well, maybe we'll just play it as we start the show one day. I don't know that.
He would be fine with that.
Okay.
He'll be happy with it. He won't sue us over copyright infringement.
Well, if Zuckerberg flags us, we'll get him to make the phone call and get it erased.
Yeah, because he can probably get directly to Mark because he's a recording star.
There you go.
Yeah, so.
Well, Joel, you have a very special guest lined up for today's show, and he's going to be calling in just a couple of moments, huh?
Yeah. We've got Matthew Finstein is going to be joining us. He's a great friend of mine, one of my best friends in the world, actually. He lives in Israel. He's from Texas. He's a Texas boy that ended up in Israel, out of the Dallas area, and ended up in Israel 15, 16 years ago now, I think. And he ended up there. He went on a tour of Israel where there we go. Here he comes. Let's just bring him in and we can stop the introduction and start the talking.
All right. We've got the guest online, Joel, if you would.
Matthew, is that you, buddy?
It is indeed.
Oh, it's so good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's great to hear yours. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. Thanks for joining us. I was just giving them a little bit of a primer on who you are. And other than telling them that you're one of my best friends in the world, I was kind of at the end of the primer waiting on you to call. But to start by giving us a little background for you in Israel, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure and it's an honor to be able to speak to you all from Israel. I moved here about 13 years ago from Dallas, Texas. Currently, I'm a tour guide. I also have a building business, construction business here in Israel. And my family and I, my wife, we have two boys, a dog, and we live in southern Israel. We live about 1 mile south of the West Bank border. I guess you could call it a border.
There's a big wall there, right?
There is a territory that belongs to the Palestinians, but it's also part of Israeli security. It was a territory that was won by Israel during the 1967 Six Days War. It's been within Israeli hands since the end of that war. It was previously Jordanian territory.
Okay.
So we're right south of that, what we would call a border, more of a security line. And that's where we are.
And you're how far north of Gaza? Because that's what, you know, in America, everybody knows where Gaza is, sort of.
Actually, I'm about 30 miles east of Gaza.
Okay.
I'm actually a little bit southeast of Gaza.
I didn't realize you were far south.
I can actually see at nighttime the lights from Gaza. We can see the city lights, generally speaking. We can see the glow from that general area as our little village sits on top of a mountain. And we can see pretty far out. On a clear day, we can see almost to the sea, almost to the Mediterranean.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty unnerving. And, you know, we've talked about the war here on the radio program. And, in fact, we've had several of the radio listeners, including the lady that owns this station, who have donated to the money that we've been sending you for your village and for you guys.
Right.
In the war, so.
Thank you so much.
Well, no, absolutely. But I know one of the things they want to hear is what's it like there right now for you? What is life like on a day-to-day basis?
Well, for the first, you know, for the first 3 months that this war started, October 7th really changed the way that we operate our lives in general. And I'm speaking on behalf of just about every Israeli here in the country.
Right.
Everything ceased, everything stopped, nobody went back to work. And that was the same for us. It was the same for my wife and I here in this village, the same with the villagers here. We simply just stopped doing what we were doing, put everything on hold, and put our attention and focus on our personal security, where we were at for at least the first few days. Within actually the first couple of hours of October 7th, many people living here in this village were called up for their reserve duty and were sent directly to their bases, got uniforms, rifles, and went to train for a war. And that was also on October 7th. So me being an American, I wasn't trained as an IDF soldier. I was in the American Army. But being here allows me to facilitate the security of our village with the other members of our village that remained here as well. So that's what I've been doing personally. The first 3 months that this war started, I was really focused. I'm staying here in the village, my wife as well.
Mm-hmm.
We put our jobs on hold. We went to train. We started our own training. And since then, we've heightened security. We've gotten lots of donations from groups all around the country, also in America, especially you guys. And we've increased our security. We've increased our ability to secure ourselves. And I think that was what's most important for us. We're not relying on the army to safeguard us. We're not relying on the local police department to keep our security. We were able to do that on our own because of donations like yours, definitely. Yeah.
That's nice.
The last month or so has been a bit different. And I think even for most Israelis would agree, there has to be some level of normalcy to return.
Right.
Simply, if you remember back in 9/11,
mm-hmm.
The first few months after the United States was attacked, we were all in a sort of shock. Even the Congress was trying to decide if we go to war or not. Similar concept here in Israel. At some point, we need to go back to some level of normalcy. My wife has obviously returned to her 9-to-5 job,
mm-hmm.
as with most villagers that can. Most men who were in infantry units, women as well, excuse me,
we have
women infantry here in Israel as well, that are capable of serving are still serving. And similar to that in America, where we have a rotation for fighting overseas, it's very similar to Israel as well. So what they plan to do is every 3 months start rotating reserve soldiers in and out of the front to give them some type of relief, et cetera.
And you've got the front on the north and the south, right? I mean, you've got a front there at Gaza,
right.
And you've got another front up at the Lebanese-Syria border in the northern side.
Right. Hezbollah, according to Israel and the United States, considered a terrorist organization.
Yep.
And they are allied with Iran, and they smuggle in weapons through Syria, from the Iranian border through Syria into Iran. And that's why you hear a lot on the news, Israeli airstrikes in and around Damascus in Syria. Those are Israeli airstrikes attacking Iranian supply trains going towards southern Lebanon.
Right.
To arm Hezbollah. And you remember when we visited southern Lebanon just a few years ago, we could see the poppy fields growing mm-hmm. in southern Lebanon, right there on the border.
Yep.
Poppy fields are used by the farmers who are forced to grow these agricultural products to fund heroin production for money, not to sell drugs in Lebanon, so to speak, but really to make drugs worldwide and to make money for Hezbollah
mm-hmm.
and things like that. So we are faced with that border. Even before this war, we were faced with the Hezbollah threat.
Right.
And because of the war, Hezbollah has heightened their threat towards Israel. And we're faced with a difficult decision with this border. The IDF is faced with a difficult decision because we're also in the middle of a negotiation with Hamas in Gaza to get back some of these hostages, which were taken 4 months ago, and even women and children.
How many hostages are still in captivity, Matthew?
It's difficult to say because we don't know the numbers that have deceased, unfortunately, right. But well over 100 okay. still.
Yeah.
And these negotiations put a ceasefire into play with Hamas, and Hezbollah is using this war as their weight on a war against Israel, basically. If we're at war with Hamas, then Hezbollah has the right to attack Israel as well. So if we have a ceasefire with Hezbollah, or with Hamas, then Hezbollah would also enjoy that ceasefire as well. So it's very difficult for the IDF to make these decisions. I'm not in the IDF. I can't speak for them, unfortunately.
Right.
I didn't get my time to serve in the same way that my wife did, but... that's really the atmosphere around us. What will happen in a ceasefire? Will there be a rearming of Hamas and Hezbollah in the north? Mm-hmm. We have almost 200,000 residents that have fled these borders that are not allowed to go back to their homes because they live too close to either front. And if we have a ceasefire, we would like that these families be able to return back to their homes, but it really also depends on the potential threat after the ceasefire.
Right. It depends on whether or not we get to peace. Now, one of the cool things I think you did was in November around Thanksgiving, you guys had an American-style Thanksgiving that you put on for the village.
Yeah.
And so your village, how many families or people are we talking about living in this area where you are? And what I want people to understand is when this is not like living in America or even living in Europe where you've got a village, but then you've got houses all around it. This is basically... surrounded by desert. There's you live in the village or you don't live in this area to a large extent as far as permanent housing.
Right.
So when we talk about this is a very small and confined village, mentally speaking. I mean, it's not far from anything because it's Israel, but it's small. But tell us a little bit about that, about your Thanksgiving, how many people you have in the village, and just give us a feel for that.
Well, we have about 60 families here in the village. We are expanding. We are building a new neighborhood. It's been in the works for about 10 years now. Many families are going to move here as soon as they build their homes. But currently, we're about 60 families living here now. That's not too many homes in general. It's about 60 homes, more or less.
Everybody gets a home.
Yeah, basically. I mean, if you can build one, then that's the way it goes. We're considered the periphery, so we're pretty far away. We're about an hour and a half south of Jerusalem. We're about, if you have a map of Israel or you're able to follow along, we're about 20 minutes northwest of the city of Arad. So we're actually really close to the Dead Sea. We're really close to the desert. Mm-hmm. However, right out west of us is one of Israel's largest forests called the Yatir Forest. It's a really beautiful green area. So the east is desert, the west is forest, really unique area. But 60 families, and we threw kind of a surprise Thanksgiving dinner this year. We had, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't remember the number, I think it was 8 turkeys that we cooked for the families. I sent out a newsletter to those who are following what's going on here in our village, and we cooked about 8 turkeys together. We invited, of course, all the families in the community, as well as other families who have been displaced from this war. So there are many families that literally lived along the border of Gaza in an Israeli village, very similar to ours, actually, and also considered the periphery. And they're displaced. So we invited a lot of these families over to enjoy this Thanksgiving. So we're all very thankful that we're here, that we're alive, that we haven't lost anybody, that... of course, we're all in prayer and worship that our soldiers will come home safely, and that these hostages will also come home to their families. But that was a real fun event, despite just a month before this war started. So the atmosphere during Thanksgiving was very eerie. It was a very difficult time at that time as well. Of course, our security in the village was at its highest as well. So we were doing patrols at that time, 24 hours a day.
But Matthew, you have a company that patrols the village at night in non-war times, isn't that right?
So normally these villages, you know, since the beginning, even before the State of Israel was established, when Jews came to the land, let's say before World War II, between World War I and World War II, Jews were immigrating to the land of Israel, and they were establishing communities, and there was really no government at that time that could protect one village from another. It was really dependent on the village security of its own. Mm-hmm. And that really stayed, it was inherited into every village that continues to grow within Israel, including settlers in the West Bank. These are also villages, very similar to the village that we live in.
Right.
But so they have this mindset of keeping their own village safe and secure, their own personal security, and it's part of the government now. It's part of, we don't have a constitution in Israel, but it's very much similar to a constitutional right that we have the ability to safeguard and protect our own villages,
right.
Sort of like a militia. So we have now the ability to hire private security to patrol our own village, especially at nighttime. Mm-hmm. Before the war, during these nighttime hours, we would have this private security come for us. And of course, we pay for that in our membership of the community, basically. Sort of like a gated community, in a sense, that you would have similarly in the States. So it's a private security that would come. But when the war started, we took over from the private security, and we took it upon ourselves once again to safeguard our own village, the gates, make sure that they're locked, the security cameras are working properly, and to do patrols in and around the fences, to work with other communities in the area as well. They're not too far away from our village.
Right.
We also have agriculture in the area. We need to make sure that that's protected and it doesn't... nothing gets stolen from the agriculture,
exactly.
From farmers, you know.
Well, you know, Bob Dylan's saying that it's a desert paradise that's been turned into a garden land, and that's one of the things I love about Israel is the Israelis really have turned this, what is the, considered the Fertile Crescent out by the coast, but even back in the inland areas, the desert areas, they're turning it into a very productive agricultural land like nobody's ever seen before. And it's amazing to see firsthand.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's a good thing you brought that up. It's one of the things that Israel has pioneered in terms of advancements in technology is geared towards agriculture. And a lot of our peace negotiations that we've had with Egypt and Jordan, and even recently with the Abraham Accords with other Arab nations, and what was about to become a really amazing peace with Saudi Arabia, even.
Mm-hmm.
Had a lot to do with agriculture, how to make the desert bloom. These Arab countries are not the oasis of the desert that Israel really is.
Yeah.
We have the abundance. We can at least harness water in so many unique fashions. So,
no, and it really is amazing. You know, this is going to sound weird, Matthew, even to you, but every time I go to Epcot at Disney World in Orlando, Florida, We go to this ride that's a little boat ride through this area called the Land, and they start off with the evolutionary history of land and how the Midwest was broken up by the buffalo herds and their hooves softened the ground and made it fertile and so on and so forth. But you end up riding through a desert area where there's literally sand, and they're showing how we're learning to grow plants in the desert with targeted watering. And I know Israel leads the world in desalinization of water, which is taking salt water and turn it into fresh water. Y'all are on the edge of that technology and provide a lot of the water in the country is provided that way, and water you provide to the rest of the Middle East is that way to a large degree. But it's amazing to watch how they've figured out exactly how much water a plant needs, and they feed that water in individually through a very technical thing. And a lot of that is research that's happened because of the work that Israel's doing, I think.
Absolutely. The drip irrigation system that you see worldwide was invented here in the 1950s, actually. Excellent ability to use water efficiently, to drop droplets of water directly onto the root system of the plant. And in some cases, we've been able to bury this irrigation line into the earth, so it's even closer to the root system. Of course, it's not good for every type of plant, but
right.
It does merely do the job of what we needed to do, depending on what we're growing. And it could also allow for the beautification of roadsides. You know, driving along the highway in desert areas, you don't have sand blowing into the road because the grass is holding on to this earth for us. And that drip irrigation really helps a lot in this area as well.
No, that's
and you see it all over the world.
Yeah. And that's amazing. Matthew, we've got to take a break. So you're going to be listening to commercials for a couple of minutes here. But remember, that's how we stay on the air. And then we'll be back. And when we come back, I want to shift gears and talk a little bit about some sites in Israel. I'd like it at some point. I'd like for you to talk about what your favorite site to lead a tour of Americans is. So we'll talk about that when we come back from the break. Thanks, Matthew.
Great.
We're talking to Matthew Finstein today, who is a tour guide extraordinaire. He's the best tour guide I've ever met. He's an amazing guy. He's humble, so he's not going to acknowledge that. But he's become one of my best friends in the world. David Thornton is watching us on Facebook, so shout out to David. And David sends his love to you, Matthew. But we're talking about Israel.
He hesitated a little bit before he sent that shout out, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I hate to give David credit. He's liable to show up at the studio and start talking. But Matthew knows David, so he knows how that goes.
The king.
Yeah. Yes, King David. So Matthew, we talked about before the break, and for you guys that were expecting a heavy Israeli accent because we've got someone who lives in Israel, Matthew moved to Israel by way of Texas, Dallas, Texas, so he's a Cowboy fan. In fact, Matthew, I understand that you put in your will that you want to be lowered by, you want to have 6 pallbearers from the Dallas Cowboys at your funeral because you want them to let you down one more time when you die?
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. Well, it looks like it's a Chiefs 49ers game this year, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and we're all rooting for the 49ers.
Another year without the Dallas Cowboys. That's okay.
Well, and believe it or not, another year without the Atlanta Falcons. I know you're shocked. And you know, I'm for the 49ers just because I don't want Taylor Swift to win. I'm so tired of seeing Taylor Swift in the president's box at the games that I just and I don't have any enmity against her. I'm just not impressed with her. Anyway, let's get back to what we're here for because I could get lost in a rant here and you could be sitting on the air and not just listening to me and that's not fun for you. Let's talk about touring some. I want at some point to talk about Shiloh because it's one of those settlements in the West Bank that you were talking about. But before we get to Shiloh and kind of talk about our experiences there, because you've led me there on tours 3 or 4 times now, I'd like to get from you, what is your favorite site whenever you've got a bus full of American Christians who are following the steps of Jesus? What is your favorite place to take people to and talk to them about?
Jerusalem, without a doubt. Easy, I don't even have to think about it. Jerusalem is what brought me here. It's the center of really 3 monotheistic religions around the world. Everybody knows Jerusalem, has heard of Jerusalem, even countries around the world that are not Muslim, Christian, or Jewish have heard of Jerusalem or know of its great importance of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And its archaeology there is just absolutely astounding. The reality on the ground, you can see with your own eyes, walk the streets, feel with your own hands the places that we've read about in the Bible.
Right.
And there is no other place like that in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So Jerusalem, definitely, without a doubt.
And within, I mean, you know, the Jerusalem, I wasn't thinking you'd say that because when I think of Jerusalem, I think of it in terms of sites like the City of David, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Mount of Olives and all of that. So,
well, it's interesting, these names that you bring up, these names are sites within Jerusalem for sure.
Right.
They're all just a mix of history and archaeology. If I were to hone it down even further, it would definitely be the City of David, which is in Jerusalem itself.
Yeah.
And if you really picture what Jerusalem should have looked like 3,000 years ago, it is the City of David. It is none of the other sites that you just mentioned, like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, even the Western Wall itself, this holy place in Judaism, was not in the City of David 3,000 years ago when David established the Jerusalem that we so love. So it is this little tiny sliver of land, this archaeological park today within Jerusalem, that is often visited by most Christian groups. mm-hmm. where you can see numerous things mentioned in the Bible, from Hezekiah's water tunnel, which saved the city 2,700 years ago from the Assyrian conquests and established a new pool of water, of fresh water within the city limits called the Pool of Siloam, mm-hmm. which we know 2,000 years ago is where Jesus healed the blind man. So this right. this city has a lot to offer in terms of archaeology, in terms of theology, in terms of faith, to be able to walk these streets, especially mm-hmm. today. And almost every day, just about every day, except for Sabbath day, yeah. They are uncovering something new there archaeologically that, again, proves the Bible. And I think that's important today because there's a lot of disbelief in the mm-hmm. Bible.
Yeah.
Whether it's a disbelief in faith or not, there's certainly a theory that the Bible is just another mythological story, similar mm-hmm. to Greek mythology.
Right.
But when you walk in the City of David, when you see the archaeology, it just comes alive.
You know, and the archaeology that you're talking about, Matthew, is amazing because the City of David archaeological site is very close to being doubled what it was the first time you and I went together, because they've opened up across the street. And I understand you got a tour of some of those new areas of the City of David.
Yeah, so right across the street, it's hard to imagine this visually, but just right across the street used to be a parking lot for private vehicles.
The first time I was there, it was a covered. Yeah. It was a parking lot. It was an asphalt parking lot when you looked over the fence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. And now they've dug about 70 feet below that parking lot. Now, it's important to try and keep an idea. 70 feet in a flat area. This area is not flat at all. This is a sloped mountain slope that we're talking about. Jerusalem sits on the peak of a mountain. It has a very steep slope. So 70 feet down, we're basically going all the way down to the bedrock of the slope. So over 3,000 years of history, just of junk and garbage, the city being destroyed numerous times, mm-hmm. building new apartments up above, higher and higher and higher over 3,000 years. Eventually, what was down below is forgotten. And eventually, somebody decided to pave a parking lot there, thus preserving all of this history underneath. So, of course, once we discovered the discovery that we have in the City of David, we decided to continue across the street. The archaeological park purchased this area of the parking lot mm-hmm. and began their archaeological excavation over the last decade. And they're still digging. They're still trying to understand what they're looking at as well. It's a painstakingly long process. Archaeology. Mm-hmm. We have to understand every little piece of pottery that is taken out of one little area, and to mark it and to note it, and what type of pottery it came from, or what site within this archaeological site it came from. And it gives us the answers and the clues to what we're actually looking at. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at it from just a general photograph, it looks like just a bunch of rubble. But we have to kind of piece it together like a puzzle.
Yeah.
And to be able to tour this site with your own eyes, you get a better understanding of what you're looking at. The defensive part of the city, the moat of the city, the nobility's homes, the administration of King David, the library of the kings of Israel, these are all being uncovered right now.
Wow. And you and I came upon that when we were there in February of 2022 with Pastor Rob. We came up there from the Pool of Siloam. I'm sure you remember that day. I don't think I'll ever forget that day, because that's the day I told God very verbally that if he would let me live through this experience, I would never do this again.
I think the call dropped.
Okay,
so we want to take our last break.
Let's take our last break and we'll get him back on.
All right, we'll be right back. This is Later This Morning in Rome with Joel Thornton. We'll return.
Matthew, I know that's what we call a pregnant pause in the radio business. That tunnel experience, which really wasn't a tunnel, I'm going to leave it to you to describe what it actually was a turning point in my life, I know.
So yes, I have photographs of that day specifically. We took a really interesting tunnel experience from the Pool of Siloam uphill along the bedrock all the way to the Western Wall. Basically, we were doing a pilgrimage route that was a route from thousands of years ago where pilgrims would come through to the Pool of Siloam and make their pilgrimage up to the Temple Mount where the Temple of Solomon stood. So that route that we were taking was a reference, was in use by pilgrims. Now, what the specific route that we were doing was actually the drainage channel underneath the road. So we were underneath this road that the pilgrims were walking up, and we were walking basically up the sewage line.
Exactly.
So, of course,
a 2,000-year-old sewer.
Yeah, yeah, 2,000-year-old sewer line. And it looked perfect. It was still standing, perfectly operational, actually, if we wanted it to be. The stones were perfect. They looked like they had just been hewn yesterday. Mm-hmm. It makes us think about our current technology for sewage systems, but certainly was an experience for Joel. Had I did not realize that we were going to be in such a tight and cramped area. But what's interesting about this sewage system is now the road above it. And for decades now, they've been excavating this road, the actual pilgrimage road itself, and now they're opening it up to the public. And this is what was really exciting about my tour a few months ago, was taking this breathtaking tour up the steps that pilgrims took literally on the very steps 2,000 years ago, the same stairs that Jesus would have taken all the way up into the Temple Mount from the south through the southern steps. And this is all being revealed now and opening up to the public. And what's interesting about this road is it's also underground because we are building histories, a layer cake of history in Jerusalem. Remember, it's one layer after another layer for thousands of years. And we have another road, the modern road, above this road. So we've built this tunnel, this an arcade, this archway holding the main road above it, the main operational road of Jerusalem above our heads. Well, we can take groups now along the very stones that these pilgrims took 2,000 years ago to reach the temple.
And that would have been an open air area at the time, right?
It would have been open to the air, of course, definitely. Now, what you and I took was even below that, was the sewage drain underneath that. So,
And you haven't done that justice, Matthew, because it kept getting smaller and smaller, shorter from the height and narrower. At one point, I had to turn my shoulders sideways to get through an opening. And, of course, I'm extremely claustrophobic.
The reason why it got so shrunk like that was because the collapse of the road above it over time.
I'm glad I didn't know that at the time.
Crushed down into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Aren't you glad you're not an archaeologist?
Well, I couldn't have been an archaeologist because tight spots and I do not get along. Even when I wasn't as big as I am now, tight spots and I didn't get along. That's one of my greatest fears. I tell people all the time, I'm going to be cremated because I'm not convinced that you're not conscious once you're dead. And being in that box under 6 feet of earth is the biggest panic I can think of. So I'm going to be cremated and that'll solve that problem. I know that's a morbid thing to say, but I'm half teasing. But yeah, I mean, that was an amazing moment. Matthews rescued me. I was about to have to get on my hands and knees to finish the climb. It was getting so narrow. And I knew if I got on my hands and knees, I was not going to be able to get myself out. And so I started calling for Matthew, who came down and talked to me like you would talk to a lost puppy that looks like somebody's been beaten at half to death and you're trying to calm the puppy down. And he's like, "It's okay, Joel. We're just right up here. Come on, give me your hand. I'll get you out of here." I mean, he really helped soothe me a great deal and got me out of there. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful, even though I'm not going back in any tunnels with you, Matthew.
Well, you'll do the pilgrimage road with me. This tunnel is wider, much nicer.
Yeah, I'll do the pilgrimage road. That's not really a tunnel.
More suitable for groups as well.
Yeah.
No, not really.
And we had hoped that was going to be open when we got down there because we knew we were going to have to walk back up because it was just the three of us and, and you were driving our car for us, and we didn't have a way to get the car down to us and walk down there. So we thought that they'd been saying the pilgrimage road was open. We get there and find out it's not. And you're like, oh, don't worry, there's another way out over here.
Right. Right.
But that was really a good day, though. And one of the other good times that I've had, which is really a spot that a lot of tours don't go to, is the site of Shiloh, what we call Shiloh here.
Right.
And everybody that grew up in a Baptist Sunday school has heard of Shiloh because there's some hymns that sing about Shiloh. I'd like to talk about that because that is one of the settlements you were talking about earlier in the West Bank, which is literally... I'd like you to explain how a settlement occurs, because most people don't when they hear, well, this is an Israeli settlement and there's conflict over that, and there's a lot of conflict today over whether or not they're allowed or not. Trump supported them. Biden doesn't support the settlements. So give us a little bit of background on that.
Yeah, well, of course, the settlements are areas that when Israel was established in May of 1948, we created borders at the end of the Independence War, and we were still at war with these Arab nations that were bordering our country. But we have basically Egypt coming from the south, and they conquered the area today known as the Gaza Strip. And Jordan conquered the area from the east. It's sort of like a backwards uppercase B within the center of Israel. Mm-hmm. And their main goal was to make it to the Mediterranean Sea, to both armies to reach the Mediterranean, or to Tel Aviv, basically.
Right.
So when this territory was conquered by Israel in 1967, it became basically a military zone. This area was not a part of Israel in the establishment of the state in 1948, but is now a part of Israel's security. So Israel now conquered this territory from the enemy state, which attacked Israel, and now is holding on to this territory as a buffer zone between that neighboring state. What we didn't realize is that we were also inheriting a group of people that were living within this territory, and these are called the Palestinian people. Of course, the Palestinians were also living within Israel proper in 1948, but that can be an additional discussion at some other time. But basically, there was a larger population living in both of these territories. So after 1967, Israelis decided to move back to these territories. Now, when I say move back, I mean it both in the biblical sense, that this territory was a part of the Jewish state 3,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago as well.
Mm-hmm.
But also, prior to 1948, there were many Jews that lived in this territory that were kicked out of their homes by either Jordan or by Egypt and were forced to move towards Israel proper. And then the end of the Independence War, and they were unable to move back to their homes. So these territories, no matter where they are within the territories, any Jew or Israeli decides to move back to that territory, they are considered a settler. So this is where we get the term settlements.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the settlements became an issue in the 1990s during the Clinton administration when they were discussing peace negotiations under the Oslo Accords later on. And the settlement became a very large topic. There was about 100,000 Israeli Jewish settlers at that time that were living in both of these territories, in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank. And the question basically was, what do we do with these territories? And Shiloh happens to be one of these territories. It's about half an hour drive north of Jerusalem, the Jerusalem before Jerusalem, you could say,
right,
where the tabernacle rested for many years, hundreds of years.
369 before... years.
Yeah, exactly.
I learned that from you, Matthew.
Years. So this is the place, the home of the Ark of the Covenant that we know, the tabernacle itself, the priests, and this is where the 12 tribes would gather together during the three feasts a year. And this is an incredible archaeological site. But of course, 1967, especially Orthodox Jews, wanted to go back to this site. They wanted to go back to many sites mentioned in the Bible. This was the land given to the Jewish people. This is the promised land. And they wanted to live back on this land. as we once did 2,000 years ago. So Shiloh today, yes, is a settlement. There are Arab villages which surround the village of Shiloh. In 1967, when we came into this territory, we actually didn't know where Shiloh was, and that's what's really amazing part about this archaeological site. One of the Arab villages in the area actually had a name very similar to Shiloh, so we assumed that the name carried with the Arab village over the hundreds of years that Jews did not live in this area. And they decided to start the excavation there, and lo and behold, they actually found the biblical site of Shiloh. And one of the archaeological pieces of evidence was actually a Byzantine-era church, a Christian church from the beginning of Christianity, which was established at Shiloh, honoring the site of Shiloh from what we know from the Bible, from the Hebrew Bible. Of course, we know it as the place where the tabernacle was. And we know for hundreds of years that the 12 tribes of Israel gathered there for their pilgrimage to eat, to have a feast. They would bring a sacrifice to God. A portion of that sacrifice would go to God, and a portion of that would be given to the member of the family which brought that sacrifice. And they could take a piece of that sacrifice home with them and to cook it as a meal. But you don't really go home. You're far from home. So what you do is you usually cook that meal right there in front of the tabernacle with your family in a pot, in a jar. You cook that stew, basically, and you have a feast with your family, and the other families of your tribe are also there with you. And what is so fascinating about this tradition is the meal itself is so special, is so holy. The meat itself was part of a sacrifice that the pot that it was cooked in could never be used again. So they immediately smash the pot right there on the ground. Mm-hmm. After the meal is finished, gather their belongings, and to go home. Today, we collect our garbage and we throw it away. But back then, they simply just smashed the pot on the ground, and they would walk away. And that left a really unique piece of archaeology. You say 369 years, right? Mm-hmm. That's a lot of pottery, which piles up over the years. Obviously, the grass grows, the earth takes it back. But it does create a layer of history in the site.
Right.
And when you're standing in Shiloh, when you're standing in the site that we believe the tabernacle stood, you will realize that there is no pottery in that area. Mm-hmm. There is no pottery at all. But only the slopes surrounding Shiloh, sort of like this beautiful amphitheater. So we're talking about the Super Bowl coming up. When you're watching the Super Bowl game, and you're watching these football players play the game, just imagine what it must have been like at Shiloh, the surrounding area and the stadium-like natural setting, mm-hmm. that has the tabernacle at the center. That is the football game.
Right.
And nobody's eating their meal there. Everyone's eating their meal, their popcorn, right, and their hot dogs,
right.
on the slopes surrounding Shiloh, all right? Mm-hmm. But looking down at the tabernacle itself, watching this fire burn as God takes his sacrifices as these families come from all around the country. So Shiloh is a really beautiful area. So we notice that there's no archaeology there at all, and that makes it a really fascinating site.
Yeah, it does. And that's also where Samuel was and where he heard the call of God, the prophet that anointed David. And they're just now discovering a lot of those pottery shards. In fact, the last time you and I were there, we toured with one of the guys who's written the book about the area, who's an archaeologist, and he was talking about how they've just uncovered all of these shards from exactly the moment you're talking about, which it reinforces the idea that it's there. Matthew, unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to do this again because this has been the most fun I've had on radio in a long time. And I didn't get to rant at all, which is a little disappointing, but I'm glad we had a very reserved discussion. I appreciate you taking the time, and folks, this is Matthew Finstein. If you want to get in touch with him, get in touch with me, and I'll put you in touch with him. He's putting out a newsletter showing pictures of his video. We're going to take some of those pictures, Matthew, and use them on a podcast that Matt
Please,
is going to make out
to
of this.
Please, you're welcome to share the newsletters. Yeah. You're welcome to share everything I've sent you as well. Please, thank you very much for having me on the radio.
It's been a pleasure, Matthew. It's always great to talk to you. Thanks, brother.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.